You know all those clear glass buildings we're seeing in cities across the United States? Well, the special glass panels they use grew out of research in the 1970s. The big energy crisis back then led to a push to make buildings more efficient. And one of the biggest success stories to come out of that crisis was the technology to make better windows. It could hold lessons for today as energy research is ramped up once again. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
Chances are you've never heard of a technology called low-emissivity window coatings. But these invisible films are the reason that architects in American cities are gleefully building transparent glass towers these days, like this one in Portland, Oregon.
So we're standing outside of what will be a 22-story tower.
Architect Mark Parapolizza watches as a crane gently hoists a panel of light blue glass up the side of the building.
This is a piece right now that's going into place and is now being suspended and positioned.
When this building is done, it will be a shimmering tower blending into the blue of the Portland sky. Parapolizza's colleague, Glenn Justice, helped design it. He says it's all about creating a feel of transparency into and out of the building.
For the apartments, the idea was the more view, the better. And so we've got glass all the way down to the floor and up to the ceiling. And in Portland, Oregon, that means views of Mount Hood and Mount St. Helens and just incredible vistas.
The building will be incredibly energy efficient, LEED platinum in the argot. That's because this glass is amazingly good at keeping heat in during the winter and out during the summer. And this coated glass is not just in glitzy skyscrapers. You'll find it in half of all new windows installed these days. The remarkable story of this glass starts during the last energy crisis, 3 decades ago, at the Department of Energy's Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. Steve Selkowitz was then, as now, working in the labs above the UC Berkeley campus.
So in the mid-70s, people looked at energy use and they said, okay, we need more oil, but at the same time, what can we do about reducing the need for it?
So Selkowitz and other physicists sat down for a brainstorming session to figure out how to reduce that need. They came back with a rather surprising answer. A huge amount of America's energy was literally going out the window, wasted. So while the Department of Energy was passing out billions of dollars for research to produce even more fossil fuels, Selkowitz landed a very modest grant, a few million dollars, to develop more efficient windows.
The concept actually existed. The materials existed. There were patents out there. There was some early exploratory work in Europe. What was missing was the pieces weren't put together in a way that you had a viable product that could be deployed at scale.
To help explain what he's talking about, Selkowitz takes us over to a tabletop demonstration with two miniature windows.
If you look at the two pieces of glass alone, I just pull them up here and hold them up to the light, you can't possibly tell the difference between these, right?
That's
true.
They
just look the same.
But then Selkowitz puts them in front of heat lamps.
So what we've got is we have heat lamps in here representing the sun. I'm going to turn the sun on in a second with this knob, and I've got a little radiometer that spins around here, and the faster it spins, the more solar energy is coming through. And we have two kinds of glass here, so we can basically see by just watching what the radiometer does, which of the two glasses is the best protection against the sun. So here we go. And the one on the left is spinning like crazy, and that's just ordinary glass. And the one on the right is spinning very, very slowly.
And that's because the glass is coated with an invisible film that blocks half the light, the invisible infrared rays. Glass like this prevents a house from overheating in the summer, and it holds in heat in the winter. Simple, amazing, and nobody was using it in anything bigger than an airplane cockpit window. Selkowitz realized that the challenge for low-E glass wasn't inventing it, but breaking down the barriers that kept it from the marketplace.
The people that make the low-E glass don't sell you windows. The window manufacturers looked back at the glass guys and said, this is a coating, we can't see it, we can't touch it, we can't feel it, how do we know it works? How do you know this is the emperor's clothes problem? How do you know that something invisible really works?
So first, Selkowitz had to sell the idea to window manufacturers. To do that, his group made simple tools the window makers could use to prove to themselves and their customers that the low-E glass really worked. The lab's experts also stepped in to settle factual disputes in the industry about whose product did what.
We were the evangelists of truth of the low-E window.
All this gave the windows a foothold in the marketplace, and as more and more sold, they got cheaper. That, in turn, allowed states like California to write tougher, energy-efficient building codes in order to prod builders to use the windows. All in all, with just a few million dollars, the federal scientists became the midwives of this technology. True, it's not as sexy as inventing new gizmos to generate clean energy, but the end result is that it has saved consumers literally billions of dollars, according to a study by the National Academy of Sciences. Berkeley professor Dan Kamen says one lesson here is that energy efficiency overall has given us by far the biggest bang for our 1970s energy research buck.
We now see that by continuing on a path to make our buildings more efficient, to make our lighting systems better, to make the heating systems better, that in fact the states that embrace that are just dramatically different than the national average.
Another secret of success here is that the Lawrence Berkeley Group has somehow managed to keep working on the technology even after the government abandoned most other energy research in the mid-1980s, when oil prices dropped and the energy crisis seemingly came to an end.
The classic example is that President Carter put solar panels in the White House, President Reagan took them off.
Today, funding for clean energy research is about what it was in the 1960s, Kamen says. But the Berkeley lab is still working to develop the next generation of windows.
So we're walking up now to our 71T building.
Christian Kohler, who works with Steve Salkowitz, points up to an odd little structure with three enormous windows all facing due south so they get maximum sunlight. They actually hate shade up here.
The gardeners are like, why do you want us to cut the trees back? You know, this is the way we cut them all. We're like, well, we want our south exposure.
Inside, researcher Eleanor Lee says there's still plenty of room to improve energy efficiency in windows. They're now working on windows with three layers of glass to help keep sunlight out in the summer and heat in the winter. But she adds the goal is no longer the narrow one of energy conservation espoused by President Jimmy Carter back in the dark days of the last energy crisis.
Turn down the thermostat, wear a sweater, right? These days, people want energy efficiency with the amenity.
Features like automated shutters that not only save energy, but might appeal to design-savvy architects like the firm in Portland. Richard Harris, NPR News.
You know the classic fish story. I once caught a fish this big. Well, a team of scientists can now brag it caught a fish this deep. 8 kilometers deep, or almost 5 miles down. It's science out of the box. Scientists from Japan and Britain have just released the first photos and videos of a species of fish that lives at least 4.8 miles deep in the Pacific Ocean's Japan Trench. The old record was just 4 miles underwater. Monty Priad directs the group leading this research, Ocean Lab at the University of Aberdeen. He joins us on the line now from Scotland. Thanks for joining us.
Hello there.
So I'm looking at the video right now online. We're putting it on our website, npr.org.
Yeah.
The fish, to me, they look like bullfrog tadpoles. They're like big blobs in the front with wavy tails.
Yes, they belong to a group called the Liparidae. And the common name for the liparids is either tadpole fish or snailfish. The official common name is snailfish. But these Hadal species live deeper than 6 kilometers. They never occur any shallower.
Did scientists have any idea that anything lived that deep? Anything that was a vertebrate anyway? A fish?
Well, there is one record for one fish that was caught at 8.5 kilometers, Abyssobrotula, but that's just one dead specimen was dredged up, and it's never been confirmed. And that particular species has an average depth of occurrence of just 4 kilometers, so we now regard that as a vagrant. This species that we're seeing here was known from Russian and Danish expeditions, but they had trawled them up from shallower depths, and we only have 5 dead specimens known to science previously. So we've got the film of the world's deepest living fishes.
How'd you get the camera down so deep?
Well, the problem is a steel wire 10 kilometers long, which is the ultimate depth we're aiming at, tends to break under its own weight. Mm-hmm. So what we've used is a free-fall lander. We named it after these sort of lunar lander type things. It looks very similar, except we just drop it off the ship. We don't need any rocket engines, and it falls down to the sea floor. It takes about 5 hours to fall the 8 kilometers down to the bottom, and then the onboard computers activate the cameras and the lights and start filming. Then after the mission is finished, the ship comes back again, sends an acoustic command to the receiver on board the lander. The lander drops the weights and then ascends to the surface. And that's a tantalizing time, waiting for the thing to come up to the surface, and you're not sure if you're going to get anything until the lander pops up on the surface, and then they can replay the videos. And, well, the guys on board the ship were astounded last week when they saw all these fish down there.
They move really slowly. You have to imagine that having 5 miles of water pressing down on you is a lot of pressure on these fish.
Yes, it is. And they will have all kinds of special adaptations. They don't have any air spaces in them, so being squashed by the water isn't a problem. But if you subject muscles or nerves to this kind of pressure, they stop working. So these fish must have all kinds of invisible adaptations at the molecular and ultrastructural level, which we hope to study in future if we manage to catch more specimens.
I can't tell, though, because I have no point of reference. I can't tell how big these fish are in the video.
The biggest ones are just over 12 inches long. They're actually relatively normal-looking fish. I mean, they're not monsters. They're not tiny. They're just average fish. I guess that's the most important discovery, that you don't have to be all that special to live down there.
Monty Priad is the director of Ocean Lab at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. Thanks so much for sharing your fish story with us.
Well, thanks for your interest.